troop bad beams are gonna blind me, but I won't feel blue like I always do. 'Cause somewhere in the crowd there's you.
Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Ed Zarpolis at Target Insight. A little later on the program, Matt Grossman. He is an MSU professor. He's going to go through the presidential race with our Simon Schuster. But first, Ed, we've got some very interesting numbers as we're looking into the Ed Zarpolis crystal ball into 2016 on the congressional and the state legislative level. How much chance does the Democrats have of actually securing some successes in 2016 on both of these fronts?
They do have an opportunity to win. But we have to go back to 2008, 2012, and 14 to say what are their options. We know if we have another 2008 year where Obama won overwhelmingly in the state of Michigan, the Democrats should pick up congressional seats as well as probably pick up the majority in the state house. But as you look at 12 and at 14, you get a different perspective. What we've seen here in Michigan, which is historical in the view, is the fact the top of the ticket. In order for it to be successful at the bottom of the ticket, we're picking up congressional seats and winning back the majority of the House, they got to do super good. They have to break 55%. We've talked about that many times over the years. But let's look at history. What did we find in 14? What did we find in 12? We looked up in 12 the fact we find that, let's look at the first congressional district. President Obama lost the first congressional district in 2012. He won it in 8. Benachick won. We look at 14. Gary Peters lost the first congressional district. Benachick won.
And let's just think back at this, because Gary Peters won overwhelmingly in 2014. He was the
top vote getter.
The top vote getter for Democrats.
He was, as well as the whole state. He actually outperformed Governor Snyder, outperformed Ruth Johnson. He was the top vote getter in the state of Michigan.
And yet in the first congressional district, he lost, according to the numbers here, 49.5% to 46.8%. A 3% margin here.
That's true. Well, we find what happened to Barack Obama in 12 happened to Gary Peters in 14. There's a portion of Democrats, conservative Democrats, that stayed home. And if they're not motivated, remember, there was a lot of talk in 14. Remember, Schauer wasn't doing much up there. Gary Peters had to do this on his own. Gary Peters was depending on Schauer to bring out the vote. Barack Obama didn't spend a lot of time up in the UP in 12. So the bottom line is the first congressional district, though it's competitive, the congressional candidate is going to need help from the top of the ticket. We only have the president at the top of the ticket. The only thing other partisan is not a nonpartisan race, and that's a Supreme Court race. So the bottom line, Lon Johnson, in order to be competitive, is going to have to outperform the president and outperform Gary Peters over the last several elections.
And if we're taking a look at the possible top of the ticket for Republicans, Donald Trump seems to be doing pretty well up in the Upper Peninsula.
Matter of fact, a good portion of his vote does come from the top of the ticket, is from the Upper Peninsula. At the same token, the strongest support for Governor Snyder, we look at the whole thing on the Flint crisis we talked about last week, is from the UP.
And going back to what you're referring to here, we did a poll with you, Ed Zarpolis, last week, which we asked Republican primary voters, who do you blame for the Flint water crisis? And we were a little surprised by what we saw on that.
Well, over 60% said the blame goes back to the locals, Flint and the Genesee County. That's who should be dealing with this whole problem. Statewide, only 6% blamed the governor, and only 9% blamed the emergency manager who was in charge.
What was really interesting is we took a look at the numbers. So where in the state do most of the voters believe that it was a local problem? And what we saw was Upper Peninsula, yep. Northern Michigan. They say it's a Flint problem. It's a county problem. It's really not Snyder's problem.
That's correct. And it also meant that the fact that the state didn't have to do anything for Flint either. About a third of them said statewide, many up there up north said, you don't need to do anything, Governor. It's up to them to solve their own problem.
So that doesn't signal very good news for Lon Johnson. But let's go on to the other congressional races that are supposed to be competitive. We'll do the 7th congressional district here. And
well, in the 7th congressional district, he actually, Schauer lost the district. But Gary Peters basically edged out, you know, the opponent. Wahlberg actually won that district, but Gary Peters got 48.62, and Terry Lynn got 47, so barely, didn't even break 50%.
Okay, so that was still close. Gary Peters won, but it was extremely close.
But it was under 50%.
Okay, so very underwhelming victory then in that 7th congressional
district. That's true, and if you go back to 12, Barack Obama didn't win that district. Gary Peters basically edged out in that district of Terry Lynn Land. So there's another race, reason why the 7th district is so difficult to win, because the candidate for Congress has to have support from the top of the ticket.
So now as I'm taking a look here at the numbers, in the 8th congressional district, actually Gary Peters did a lot better. He actually won by, 3 percentage points over Terry Lynn. that was not what I was expecting to see here.
Well, what you had happening, in fact, is where Gary Peters was well known because of his run as congressman. Remember, he represented the lottery commission, the things where he was well known in the state. The more moderate of the state, he did very well. In his old congressional district, which made up with was part of the Trot district, he also won that part of congressional district. But the more conservative, more rural parts of the district, where he was an unknown candidate, did not have the base that he had, like in the center of the state, if he won, he won by barely a small margin, but he did break 50%.
I wonder if that's why we're seeing a lot of attention by Melissa Gilbert in the 8th Congressional District as she tries to unseat Mike Bishop. Is it because of numbers like this? Does that give them some encouragement?
It gives them encouragement because Gary Peters showed that the fact with the right message and the right candidate, and if there's good support at the top of the ticket, they do have an opportunity to beat Congressman Bishop. Not guaranteed, obviously, because this is a very Republican district, but Gary Peters showed that you can win in this district with the right message.
And then likewise, we wanted to look at the 11th Congressional District. Gary Peters won that as well, 49% to 47%. A little tougher situation there.
Well, there you have an incumbent, David Trott, very well-liked in his home district. Remember, that when Gary Peters represented that district before, you know, from his congressional days. Candidate Kumar, which would be the Democrat nominee, is not as well-known in the district. He didn't get through the primary last time. But there again, if you're looking for opportunity, trying to raise money, You know, that's Gary Peters won that district, so they're going to say, let's start it off. So that's why you have the 11th Congressional District, you have the 7th on the list, initially by the Democrats' Congressional Committee saying, look, Gary Peters did well here, we'll continue to support you, we'll see how it goes through the fall campaign, we'll see how if it's Hillary Clinton is the nominee, if she's going to look like she's going to overwhelm all the state like Obama did in 08, we'll support you. But I'll guarantee you, if the numbers begin to look like Hillary Clinton is just going to edge a small victory here in this state, the money for those two races will dissipate. And obviously, Lon Johnson basically is going to have to show that he can outperform both Gary Peters and the president from 12 and 14.
That's going to be a tough sled there. Let's move on to the state legislature because we're taking a look at where Gary Peters won in the state legislature, and there were a few seats that he did win.
Well, actually, when you look at the whole thing, there are about 19 traditionally marginal seats in the state of Michigan where Gary Peters won the House district. But out of that few districts, basically only about 9 House districts, he won by more than 50%.
Where he gained 50% of the vote.
50% of the vote. So the bottom line is the Democrats need about 9 victories.
In order to get majority, because they're down 63 to 47.
47. So there are 9 opportunities here for the Democrats to have a shot at winning. But that means basically they have to retain the seats that they have. They have to retain the Gretchen Driscoll seat. You know, they got to retain some of the other, like they did last in 14, those seats. But the bottom line, in fact, is those are only 9 seats that Gary Peters broke 50% to win that House seat. And actually one seat, the Jeff Farrington seat, it was slightly under 50%. So it's actually 8.5 seats that he got 50%. So the bottom line is there an opportunity for the Democrats to potentially win back the House? It is, but they only got really 9 real shots. Now, if we go back to Mirrors News, actually produced your top 9 districts that you looked at, and you look at your top 9, you're actually only 6 of those seats are really a solid opportunity for the Democrats to win.
And because you were taking a look at, let's say, Ed McBroom's seat in the 108th, for example.
Well, there's an amazing thing on the Ed McBroom seat, because that is a seat. And why is that such an important seat for Ed McBroom's seat? Because this is Bart Stupak won. You know, you had Democrats representing that seat before Ed McBroom. But Gary Peters lost that House seat in the 108th in 2014. That's not very good. Because that shows that seat is a very competitive seat that we're hoping, because the partisan numbers are 50%. It dropped down to 45, and actually Gary Peters ran below the party base in 2014 up there.
So that's not a very good sign.
They got to work there. That doesn't say they can't win, but they're going to have to work hard. So if Lon Johnson is going to have to work hard, House Democrats are going to have to work very hard. So they're going to have to figure out what's going to attract voters to come out and vote for Democrats up there.
Quickly, the 9 seats where Gary Peters won at least 50% were?
We're going to be looking at the 99th, the Kevin Potter seat. We know that that's top of the Democrat seat there. We know Holly Hughes seat, the Blaine Glardon seat, the 85th district. We got the Tom Barrett seat, the 71st. We got the Bison seat, represent Bison from the 62nd. 39th seat with Clint Klesko, which will be a hard one because that's a strong incumbent. And then we've got Jeff Farrington, 49.6. That's the half seat. That'll be difficult. The Anthony Forlini seat, which is the 24th in Macomb County. And the Somerville seat, the 23rd in Groseal.
And so this is interesting because of these nine you just mentioned, three of them are incumbents.
Correct.
And that makes it even that much more difficult. Although Holly Hughes and always seems like that's a teeter-tot, right?
For those of us who've been around a while, this reminds us of past state representative Ken DeBosart from Macomb County area. He'd win his term, he was off a term. There was no terms back then. He just took his 2 years off, 2 years on.
Not voluntarily.
But he was a pretty good guy. But the bottom line is Democrats have an opportunity, but it's not a guaranteed opportunity. Mm-hmm. Gary Peters shows the fact that there is opportunity here, and he broke 50% in definitely nine seats. But on the targeted seats that you were looking at specifically, it's only about six and a half seats. So it's going to be a struggle. So it's not a foregone conclusion the Democrats will take back the House.
Ed Zarapoulos from Target Insight. Thanks for joining us today and sharing these numbers with us.
My pleasure.
All right, Simon, you were able to go down to Michigan State University today. That wasn't very far for you, was it?
No, just a quick walk from my apartment, actually.
And you were able to talk with the new director of the Michigan State University Political Science Department.
Matt Grossman, who's political science, and he was recently named the new director of the Institute there.
Very good. Let's give it a listen.
So, Dr. Grossman, you are the new director of the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research, and you're looking to redevelop the Institute as a think tank aimed at policy information and education. Can you tell me a little bit about your vision for the Institute?
We want to expand the faculty involvement throughout MSU on topics of interest to state policymakers and to Michigan as a whole. So we're expanding our list of affiliated faculty. We should have in the neighborhood of 40 faculty with some level of involvement. We are continuing our grant programs to stimulate research on problems of interest to the state. We're developing some new online resources like a directory of policy relevant research and MSU policy experts. We're going to be expanding our forum series to do more topical and of the moment presentations of research related to state policy, and we will be starting a blog for informal commentary on state policy by faculty as well. So we have a lot of initiatives organized around policy education, and then we're also hoping to expand our leadership training beyond potential political candidates and new legislators to include staff and interns so that we provide sort of throughout the life cycle of politics and policy, we provide leadership training and policy education.
So you kind of envision it as a broader base of knowledge for policy-based decision-making. Do you think that there's a lack of an opportunity for a centralized area of knowledge used to inform policy?
Well, I think we're just down the street, and MSU is an obvious place to provide more expertise on policy. We're not going to be the most in the details compared to other folks in Lansing, but I think we can provide a broader perspective on what's happening in other states. Why is Michigan moving in one direction? Why, while other people are moving elsewhere, and what are the more well-known findings relating policy to the outcomes that legislators and others care about? So I don't think we will replace some of the detailed information that comes from, say, the fiscal agencies or some of the economic firms in town. I think our specialty is going to be more in the big picture, how Michigan compares to other states, and in the research findings. Where can we pull information that really says what works and what doesn't?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so moving on to the 2016 primary landscape. You know, Michigan's primary is a week from tomorrow, and right now Trump is leading in the polls in the state. What do you think it is about his candidacy that makes him, to his supporters at least, so immune to the attacks and gaffes that seem to blame more traditional candidates?
Well, first I'd look to some international examples. I would say that there's a constituency, what we usually call a nativist constituency for anti-immigration, anti-trade, in every Democratic country. And in most places, there's an opportunity for that to be a third party, like the National Front in France or the UK Independence Party in the UK. And so I think this constituency has always been there, and elites in both parties have always been more pro-immigration and more pro-trade than the public as a whole. And so there was that opening. But I think Trump has not only tapped into that existing constituency, but sort of matched it with a candidate who is already, who has been well known and famous since the 1980s, and who already had a well-known group of followers via his reality TV show and his attacks on President Obama.
So you'd say that he represents, I guess, a following of European cues in the sense that he is a figure analogous to Marie Le Pen in France, for example.
Well, I don't know as a person he is. I'm saying the voting constituency has always been there for a sort of a nativist appeal in the U.S., and we don't have a third party like that, so that constituency has to place itself in one of the two parties, and so Trump taps into that. But I also think he's been by far the most well-covered candidate in the media and therefore the most well-known in Michigan and elsewhere, and so part of his appeal is just simply that he's the well-known candidate and people are attracted to him on the basis of his personal attributes as well.
Do you see this nativist constituency solidifying into a more substantial political movement like we've seen with the Tea Party, for example?
We haven't yet seen much indication that Trump will, say, bring along with him a set of congressional candidates or Senate candidates. So we haven't seen a lot of evidence that it goes beyond Trump at the moment. But I expect to see similar kinds of conflicts play out in Republican primaries later this year if we really do see a split between traditional conservatives and the more populist or nativist appealing candidates.
So looking beyond Super Tuesday, do you think that you know, all the primaries that are slated for tomorrow, do you think that they'll offer some clarification in terms of how Michigan's primary is going to play out as we approach it?
I think people certainly look for signals from prior states about the viability of the different candidates. So, for example, Kasich, you know, may have been gaining somewhat in Michigan, but if he places very poorly across lots of states on Super Tuesday, that might convince people to go to their second choice candidate rather than him. The same thing could be said of Ben Carson. I don't necessarily think it will affect sort of Trump's support very much. I think people have either decided that they like or don't like Donald Trump so far. So I think it'll have more effect on the other candidates for those people looking for an anti-Trump alternative.
Do you think there you might see a centralization of establishment support around Marco Rubio?
It's possible, but it's going slower than people expected. That is, after Bush dropped out, people expected a lot of his support to go to Rubio in among elites, and that's happening more slowly than we might have expected. So I think Rubio's basic problem is that he's not a lot of people's first choice. He has to convince people that he's the main Trump alternative, and so far that he hasn't done that.
Yeah, and he's taken a more aggressive tack in recent days towards Donald Trump, you know, calling him out very directly in the most recent debate. Do you think that this represents, you know, an idea that he may have a finish line in sight in terms of his support?
Well, so the benefit of that is that Trump starts talking about him and the media starts talking about the conflict between him and Trump. And so he can start people can start to assume that he's the most viable Trump alternative. The problem is that in multi-candidate races, when two candidates start attacking one another, it often helps the third candidate because people don't tend to like the tone or the bitterness of the back and forth. And so that's the risk. He might be declared sort of the most viable Trump alternative. On the other hand, people's opinion of him might go down as he engages in the kind of tawdry attacks that Trump has been engaged in.
Okay, so now looking at the Democratic contest, you know, Bernie Sanders will be attending MSU on Wednesday, and he has a lot of momentum among the young electorate, but of course that isn't really translating to the delegate count. What sort of candidate do you think we'll be seeing after Super Tuesday when he appears?
Well, he hasn't changed his message a whole lot. He has been sort of on the same vein for several weeks now. The one thing that he did do did not seem to work at all. The one thing he did do was pursue African-American-based appeals in South Carolina, as did Clinton, but that really did not work. And so it remains to be seen whether, as the campaign shifts nationally, he'll be able to do much about his support remaining too narrow to win the nomination. Iowa, New Hampshire, and Vermont are the three states with the highest proportion of white liberals in the Democratic electorate. So, unfortunately, he started on pretty much the best ground for him possible. And as this contest moves to other states, that if he doesn't expand his electorate beyond that base, then Hillary Clinton will go on to win the nomination.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Simon Schuster for going to talk with Matt Grossman a little earlier today, and also Ed Zarpolis for running through some numbers. We just learned a little bit of history today, Lauren, from Abigail Walls. We just learned what the smallest unincorporated city in the United States is. And you didn't know this.
Allegedly.
She just looked it up at Google. I mean, why wouldn't that be true?
I'm looking it up on Google, and I haven't seen something.
Don't you trust her?
I mean, I do to an extent, but I'm a journalist in nature.
So it's all about verifying at this point.
It's all about verification.
Verify. What did you think of ABBA Super Trooper here?
That's a great song.
Yeah, I got kind of excited. You know why I'm doing this, right?
For Super Tuesday.
That's kind of corny, isn't it?
It's a little corny, but you know what? ABBA is great. At one point in my life, I did go see an ABBA Mania tribute concert. I covered it.
Is that right?
I did. It was great.
Did you see Mamma Mia too?
No, I've actually never seen Mamma Mia.
I bet you Abigail Walls seen Mamma Mia. You've seen Mamma Mia, I can tell.
You have some inside track knowledge, Kyle. I told you Mamma Mia.
All right. The smallest I'm going to change the subject real quick before we sign off. Smallest unincorporated city in the United States is?
Apparently it's Point of Arc, Michigan, with a population of 10 at the last census.
And it's on the thumbnail of Michigan, basically.
On the thumbnail of Michigan.
Interesting. Well, we're learning something new every day here on the MERS Monday podcast. Lauren's looking it up, and maybe she'll have more information on it after she's verified, but we won't get to that till the next podcast. And until then, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.